During this time, my mom was sad. She had very few resources. She knew no one in Seattle, really. And a friend of hers gave her a cassette tape of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh and books. He is the guru at the center of the Netflix docuseries Wild Wild Country. Yeah. And she started listening and finding a lot of meaning in what he was extolling. And she ended up, this is where the book really kicks off. She goes to India to follow Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, and she drops me and my sister off in Jersey with my dad. And that was the first time she left.
Welcome back, my friends, to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kiefhammer. Today, my guest, Ronit Plank, is a successful writer of fiction and nonfiction, an editor, a podcast host of not one but two shows, and a teacher. But long before she became all those things, she was a young girl born on a kibbutz in Israel, shuffled across the globe to Seattle by two unhappily married parents. Soon after her father left to start a new family on the East Coast, only for her mother to drop her and her younger sister on his doorstep the following year, announcing she was headed to India. Her mother was sad and lost and was given cassette tapes by a guru named Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, the man we now know as the leader of the cult featured in the Netflix documentary series Wild Wild Country. But back then, Ronit didn't know any of that. She just knew that she and her sister were abandoned repeatedly, leaving her with a deep well of grief that no one was naming as loss. In her extraordinary memoir, When She Comes Back, she explores the revelations that she discovered writing her memoir. Insights about the nature of loss when the person is very much alive. In our conversation today, to be honest, we're both deeply moved and reflective about the adultification that happens when we grow up in disorganized and chaotic households, and the importance of honoring with care those versions of us that we never got what we deserved, a safe and loving home. I can't wait for you to spend time with Ronit today. I know for sure you will be both touched and inspired by her story. Now, don't forget, if you learn something from today's conversation, which I'm certain that you will, make sure to share this episode with someone you know who might need to hear it too. And if you do it on socials, don't forget to tag me at Lisa Kiefhammer, MSW. Friends, I'm so thrilled to welcome Ronit Plank to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. It's so nice to see you again, my friend.
It's so great to do this with you. We met when you were on my show years ago. You were on And Then Everything Changed. And I'm trying to remember if you had launched this podcast at that point.
I had, but it was probably relatively new because this podcast is 5 years old. And by the time it was probably in my first season of the show. And now we're...
And now look at you.
And now we're
looking at everything you've created.
Oh, well, same. Right back at you. Listeners, you heard at the top of the show all the amazing things that Ronit does, including having not one, but two podcasts, which we'll talk about today, including Let's Talk Memoir. So, I'm just so thrilled to have you on the show. My friends, if you're listening or if you're watching on my new YouTube channel at Lisa Kiefhammer MSW, I'm holding up one of Ronit's books, but the one that I really wanted to explore today, it's her memoir. It's called When She Comes Back. And, you know, I get, like you, have the privilege of reading so many memoirs, you know, for the nature of my work. And your story and your honesty and your vulnerability and your ability to communicate detail with such the presence of who you were at 7 or 17 or 32 or whatever age you were kind of talking about is really pretty unparalleled to anything
that I've read before. And because of that, I feel like in the best way, I say this in the best way, you broke my heart over and over and over again with your story and repaired it together. And I'm just so grateful. And I think I speak on behalf of everybody who's ever read this book, so grateful for modeling that kind of, I would call it beautiful, brutiful, you know, like.
Is that your own term?
I don't know. It's sort of, it's brutal. Like brutal and beautiful all at the same time.
I feel like
it was a brutiful read, and I'm sure a brutiful experience maybe for you. So.
Well,
yeah, I just wanted
so
to start there. Yeah.
Thank you. You know, I know you read a lot of memoir and I know you're in this grief space so constantly. So to know that the When She Comes Back affected you that way means so much to me, because I know that you have an eye for story and for learning and growth, and that this is all about your work. And so to know that my memoir activated those parts in you that sort of felt seen and you were witnessing what I was trying to do really means the world to me. So thank you.
Yeah. Friends, we're going to explore a little bit of the story, not any spoiler alerts really, because the ways, as I said, that, that Ronit kind of peeled like layer after layer of her story. You're not going to even, this is not going to spoil it, but we are going to dig in deep to some of the major themes of your life, of what you helped us see. And as you indicated, I think for a lot of us, even though we haven't had maybe some of the fantastical experiences that have happened in your life, there was so much common humanity in your story around the themes of early adultified and abandonment, themes of abandonment and wounded attachment, and, you know, whatever the story of that came from. And that's, it definitely brought up some of my own stuff that I'm working on too. So we're gonna explore that today. But as you know, I start all of my episodes with my deep sort of sustained meditation on where it is we learn our earliest grief beliefs, those sets of beliefs, for better or for worse, as I often say, that guide us and sometimes harm us when we experience a profound loss in our life. And sometimes that's a death loss, but sometimes it's not. And so I wonder if I ask you that question, what is your earliest memory of loss, and how were the adults in your life modeling sort of explicitly or implicitly? What would come to mind?
I love that question. I think it's so important. I feel like we can never escape the way we were formed, right? I mean, we eventually see a way out and can choose a different way, but it's just, there's no way. We're all stuck in there and tangled up.
I think we can move forward just to add to that, but I think there's always a centrifugal force.
Yeah.
So it takes an intentional, active.
Yes.
You know, attention to.
And I feel like, and you sort of can tell and recognize in the people that you meet, those, once you know them a little bit, who have done a lot of the work. And it's very unfair that we ourselves have to extricate ourselves from these patterns and behaviors that we learned to overcome them, because it's not our fault that they were given to us. But of course we do. And that's what the work you're doing is about and what writing memoir can be. So I would say that for me, and I indicate this in the memoir, a lot of my earliest orientation, I don't know how much was nature and how much was nurture. I lived on a kibbutz in Israel, and we were very independent as kids. And my parents were both older children, and they had to both leave their families to find their own way. Their parents weren't like very attuned, and it was a different generation. And there was emotional abuse and things like that, and even physical for my mom. And so there was this idea of being self-sufficient, resilient, very urban New York Jewish in background. And so by the time I was born in Israel, I was just very self-sufficient. And there's a term for kids who are born in Israel, for people who are born there, called Sabra, which I talk about in my memoir. And Sabra is like a prickly pear. And it, the idea being that you're tough on the outside, you know, you're resilient and you can protect yourself on the outside, but you're sweet and tender on the inside. But I really gravitated toward being tough. Like, I think that I understood that I needed to be very plucky, very self-sufficient. I enjoyed being independent. Like, if you could imagine a child walking around in little combat boots, like, that would have been an image that I appreciated. Yeah. So that's kind of where my orientation toward grief and my earliest losses were leaving my homeland, leaving another place because I moved around a lot, the death of my grandmother at around the age of 9, who I wasn't super close to, but I ended up going to a funeral for, and the removal of my first kitten from our home because of her violence. And it was really just, let's move on. Let's just go move on. Like a lot of people who are listening can relate to this. Yeah. It was not, let's talk about your feelings. How are you processing this? Not what we learn now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That let's move on. I mean, in your family, that was literal often over and over again. But as you said, also that was the message. And that message was maybe somebody said those words to you, but it was definitely, I just want to draw that out. I think it was definitely, like for many of us, it was an implicit message. It was the not talking about it. It was the changing the subject when you did want to complain or show fear or sadness or anger or whatever. Like these beliefs that we learn so often, like you're just saying, including this very common myth that so many of us hold on to, that, you know, our goal in grief is to just move on and get over it, comes from those really implicit behaviors and messages. And so it's hard sometimes for us to even identify that it's a belief that we were taught or that we have, because it wasn't
like we, or maybe I liked it too. I
mean, or maybe, for sure.
But of course, you know, you have to survive when you're a kid. Anyone has to survive. That's our instinct. But I think for example, for context, my father, and we can talk about this later too, but my father was a single dad for quite a while after my mom left twice. And I don't think that he ever thought he had time nor the inclination to sit and think about his feelings and talk to us and say, I know this is hard. I know you miss your mom. I mean, we just kept motoring along. Yeah. And my mom, when she was a single mom for us for a little while, I mean, we didn't talk about the absence of my father ever.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah. No, absolutely not. And again, that's the thing. And they were raised, as you said, in some pretty abusive homes. And they were not raised generationally and because of their particular homes to talk about the things they didn't get and the dreams deferred and the losses they had. And so, yeah, whenever I ask this grief belief question, I appreciate the way you said that. And this comes back to a theme of that conversation you shared with us with your mom at the end of the book, which just blew me away, which is, when I ask people to unpack their grief beliefs, primarily that came from their childhood and the adults in their life, it's not an invitation to, you know, like come up with your angry list against your parents and how they were just did you wrong. It's really about, we can't make a different choice for ourselves. And if we have children, for our children or the people around us, our friends, our family, if we're not aware of the beliefs that we hold.
Mm-hmm.
So, so asking us to examine that isn't like, well, now I'm putting my mom and dad on a shit list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really about having some agency, because one of the things that we lose so much when we are sort of forced into a belief system, and especially when we're raised and have to early adultify, which is, I would describe as your experience, we lose some agency of like, to be a kid and to make some choices about what we think or feel, because we just go into, as you said, survival mode.
Yes. And that's what that's so when I was writing the memoir, I think that what happened for me, and I think you sort of mentioned this, is that I needed to render my parents on the page with enough depth and perspective. I needed people to understand that where they were coming from as well. So, and when I teach memoir, this is one of my favorite areas to talk about, which is writing with generosity and vulnerability and complexity, which is, you know, not there to rake people over the coals. People have to be sort of three-dimensional. And also I had to kind of go back and see what formed my father, what formed my mother. Yeah. I'm not just going to say, wow, my mom left. You know, wow, she's the villain. That's not something I'm interested in doing. I mean, maybe that's a novel, but even a novelist wouldn't do that if they wanted to have a gripping story. I needed to show what happened to my mom that made it hard for her to stay. Now, of course, one can argue that I was left by my parents at different times, but I've stayed for my teenage children. Like I've stayed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how much of it is personal choice? How much of it is what we learn and what we choose? and how much of it is just you can't avoid the patterns. But I made a different choice because of how I was raised.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and I love that. And I want to start walking a little bit through your story, as again, we're not going to go over every detail only because I want listeners to just devour this book for themselves. But I do think you did such a beautiful job. And I can imagine it was a catharsis for you too, as an individual, not just as a writer, of painting both your father and your mother, who caused you quite a lot of harm, I would say, but you painted them in their full humanity. So you didn't shy away from the ways in which their behaviors harmed you, and you also didn't paint them in a single dimension. As you said, you kind of named and reflected later on the perspective you had about their own child, how they were raised as children, or the grief, as you said, your father might have experienced having been left by your mother, you know, and left. So I appreciate the way that you do that, both for us as readers and as a model for us, for all of us who are maybe coming to grips with the complexity of our own childhoods and that impact and the legacy that that has in our lives, even especially as we face maybe another grief or another loss at this time. So you started to let us know you were born in Israel because both your father and your mother had moved to Israel and to work on a kibbutz before you were born, right? They were there.
So there was this movement. My parents, you know, they came of age like in the 60s, and my dad marched in D.C. for civil rights, and he was jailed in Mississippi trying to work with a group that was helping people who were not yet registered to vote, Black Americans, to vote. So he was looking for a way to be helpful and make change, and he was writing. He ended up what's called Aliyah, making Aliyah, which is when you go to Israel and you make your land. And that's your home. Yeah. So my mom and him met on a training farm in Jersey that prepared people for the kibbutz life, helped them learn Hebrew and things like that. And they moved there to Israel in 68. And at their second kibbutz, you know, they had me, then they had my sister. So the plan was to stay in Israel. But my whole early childhood was being raised on a communal socialist work farm. So why this is important is because the children slept in one room. Children your age would sleep in one room together. Yeah. You see your parents a couple hours a day, but the rest of the time you're kind of in a schoolroom / home with kids your age growing up in this cohort. And so you were necessarily more independent in some ways. And there were pluses and minuses to this. And in some ways, we really didn't get the bonding time with our individual mom or dad, but we learned other things. And my father makes a point, which I share in the book, that in some ways, the parents on a kibbutz got more concentrated time with their children because for 2 hours or so every day, every afternoon, everything stopped and we spent time together. We had snacks and tea and the parents saw their kids, and it was a lot more dedicated than some parents who maybe worked in the city, right?
Yeah.
So there's different ways of looking at it. But I think that I've tried to replicate in my life unconsciously and then consciously this idea of a group, this idea of a cohort.
Communal.
Like, yes. Whenever I would do a play, I used to be an actor, you know, or a movie, I'd be so happy to have this group of people or a class. Like, these are my people for a while, my tribe, basically. Yeah. But I, ironically, of course, my mom then followed a guru and she was looking for communal life, but that was not anything I wanted a part of.
No, nor, as we'll talk about and unfold, that was definitely not a place for children, for sure. And I appreciate that sort of communal thing. And I think the other thing that you bring up in the book, because eventually your family left and left the kibbutz and moved to Seattle, is not only was there some benefit to you being part of a cohort and then having that concentrated time, is your parents, in their first round of being parents, like in their early experience of being parents, had this communal system of support to help them parent.
Yes.
So that was what they learned parenting was. It was a couple hours a day concentrated, but they weren't necessarily in the day-to-day minutia and details.
Not at all. They were not on the hook for the everyday.
For anything. And so that, you all left, you shared that as you're moving, you and your young sister and your mom and dad are moving to, I think it was the Seattle area.
Yeah.
You, first of all, your mom discovers your father has had an affair.
Yeah.
Like, or, and you find this out basically on your way to Seattle. Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about what happened in Seattle, because that was one of those first losses.
So, so we left Israel, which I guess I was an aware child and I knew we were leaving. I knew the last time we were with my group at the children's house saying goodbye, like I understood something big was happening. There's even photos from that day. And then we stayed with my grandma in Brooklyn for a little while, a couple months in the summer. And then we moved to Seattle. So that's two moves already. And I'm about five. And then in, Seattle, and this is a part of me that had to work hard as a writer. The story I'd always known was we lived in Seattle. My dad left first. My dad left first, then my mom. But then I had to really dig in there and see what it must have been like to live in Seattle without having any communal support. You're a new mom, and anyone who's been a new parent, especially women, know how bleak it can feel. Even I, when I had my first kid, I remember when my husband would go to work, I just felt sort of bereft. What am I going to do with this child all day? Yeah. I'm alone. I'm on the hook for all of this, right?
Yeah.
So my mom was alone while my dad went to grad school and, you know, had his job, and she's alone in this new city without support. They didn't have a lot of money. She's with these two children all day long when she used to have friends and women around her, people to help with the caregiving. So it was very sad for her as well. And I really remember those early years as a sort of a sad gray quality, because I think my mom's emotions were obviously very apparent. She wouldn't talk about that. Why would she talk to me, a 5-year-old, about that? But
But kids feel it. That's the thing.
They do. They always feel it. And now when I had my kids and they were in preschool, I learned, it was a revelation, that you can tell your child, you know, when you do that, it really hurts my feelings. Or I'm having a hard day today, but I love you, right? Those things go so far to help a child feel secure. But my parents didn't have the tools for that. And again, I'm not lashing out. I try not in the book to lash out and say, wah, can you believe they did this? Because they were just trying to survive themselves. Exactly. So in a nutshell, shortly after arriving, they split. My dad moved out. We were living with my mom. My dad ended up moving to New Jersey across the country, so he left the family first, which is something I really understood better when I was writing my memoir.
Yeah.
The narrative I had grown up with was my mom left, but really my dad left first, and he kind of started a whole new family on the East Coast. During this time, my mom was sad. She had very few resources. She knew no one in Seattle, really, and a friend of hers gave her a cassette tape of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh and books. He is the guru at the center of the Netflix docuseries Wild Wild Country. And she started listening and finding a lot of meaning in what he was extolling. And she ended up, this is where the book really kicks off. She goes to India to follow Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, and she drops me and my sister off in Jersey with my dad. And that was the first time she left.
Yeah. Well, and you describe in such detail too, I'm sort of interested if you had that kind of consciousness at that time, or if it was part in this, in kind of the researching and talking with your parents later on, but that, you know, she sort of showed up with the kids and said, you got to take them. And he's like, wait, I don't have room. I've got this new girlfriend and she's got kids, and she's like, don't care. Got to go kind of figure it out. Did you have that kind of?
I've always remembered. So it's kind of both, because my father has told us stories, you know, throughout our lives when we would ask, me and my sister. But also I do remember things. Like I do remember being on the phone with my father, because when my mom was asking my father to take us when we still lived in Seattle and he was in New Jersey and she wanted to go to India, he said, I don't have room. You know, I don't have room for the kids. This is a small little apartment in the projects. I don't have room. And my mom had me on the phone asking my father, what about this relative? What about this relative? Can they take us? And then my mom, so part of it is cobbled together from what they told me. Part of it is my memory. And then, you know, you have some license as a memoirist.
Yes, of course.
To tell the most important parts of the story to the best of your memory. And, you know, my mom said she would have to put us up for foster care with Jewish services if he didn't take us, because she needed to go, you know? And that was when my father thought, okay, well, there's really no choice here. I must take my kids.
Yeah. That's one of the first times I think my heart was broken in the book when that happened. And at the time, your mom is saying, I need this. Nobody was naming it a cult. You didn't learn that till later on, until a camp counselor person told you that your mom was in a, what they called a sex cult, right?
Anyways,
that whole part of the story, I was like, what in the world? Nobody, hopefully nobody would do that today, but anywho.
Yeah.
But that was that part. And, you know, I just want to name one of the themes that I really was so struck by, and one of the many, many reasons I wanted to be in conversation with you on the podcast today is, you know, we often talk about death losses. And sometimes we even talk about the losses we have when parents divorce or when we have to move a lot. But in a lot of ways, to me, the central theme of your grief and loss is really around these kinds of ambiguous losses, which are the things you had a reason to expect to come to pass and didn't, which was a secure, loving, you know, parents who parented you and your ability to be a child. And in that part of your memoir, when you're talking, you know, when you're put on the phone, when your mom's putting you on the phone and trying to get you to negotiate with your dad for your own survival, basically, I was really struck how that was a moment, maybe not the moment, where you really stopped being able to be a child. Mm. That you were really now responsible for your own. It was like clear to me as the reader, right, that you were having to sort of do the protecting and the adulting that the adults in your life weren't doing in a way.
Well, I love, so I have to say, I've been meaning to tell you that I just love when someone as skilled and experienced in this kind of work as you can reflect on the book, because while I'm not a therapist, I don't have any advanced degrees. In that realm, I find it fascinating, human behavior, family constellations. I've always been drawn to that. So if I had not become a writer, maybe that's where I would have gone. But I love the close read and understanding that you bring to this, because I think I didn't have awareness any of that was happening. And of course, do you know that I never even learned the term parentification until a couple of years ago? Yeah. I first heard it and thought, what? And when I was working on my thesis, when I wrote this memoir, I had to write a separate paper. I spent some time talking about anxious attachment and insecure attachment, which I had never had the term for before. And then I just saw all of this coming into my creative life and my life. And I think that you just do the thing you do to survive. And as an older child, I felt really strong and happy being in that position because I was valued for it. My father explicitly would say, you know, you're such a good older sister. I mean, in my book, I end up making coffee for my father in the mornings when I'm only in third and fourth grade. I end up taking care of my sister, but I jump into it because I think subconsciously this is
where the love.
This is where the love. This is where my value comes from.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm still a very maternal older sistery type. It's not like I stopped doing that now that I have kids and all these dogs and my husband and everything. And I don't resent that. I love it. It's something that gives me value on my own terms. But back then I thought that I had to cook dinner to save the family somehow. And that's all subconscious. I didn't know that.
Of course.
So then what happened was in the book, as readers will see, is that while I really took it to heart and wanted to have these jobs, by the time I hit puberty, I couldn't push it fast enough away from me. Yeah. I didn't want to be my father's partner. I didn't want to do anything resembling the lady of the house. Yeah. Whereas before I needed it for my own survival.
That's the thing. And to your point, I don't know that I've ever met a kid or a teen who has that revelation then. That's only something that you can understand, especially when you become a parent, you know, around that early adultification. For many of us, particularly I think those of us in the Gen X generation, and of course those of us who lived in unstable homes, it isn't until we become parents of our own that we often recognize the ways in which we were forced to grow up too fast, to become adults before our time, and the problem that leaves us with. When we come back, we explore the perspective Ronit has on the experience of abandonment and early adultification. And we're both moved by the reading of a passage from her extraordinary memoir, When She Comes Back. You're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver. Friends, we are just over 2 months away from my book, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch, an Uncensored Guide to Navigating Loss, hitting bookstores. Oh my God. Actually, this week, I'm in the studio recording the audiobook version, and it has been so much fun to do. I really feel like I'm talking directly to each and every one of you. There are three things to know about the book release. One, you don't have to wait. You can pre-order it now on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And when you do, message me on Instagram or info@lisakeefauver.com to get an invite to my fabulous Zoom pre-launch party on my birthday, May 22nd. And two, I'm removing the distance between the screen and mic by hitting the road starting publication day, June 4th. I'm adding cities all the time, but I'm starting here in San Diego and then heading to Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Boston, and of course my hometown, Ann Arbor. Go Blue! To find out if I'm coming to a city near you, sign up for my not-so-regular newsletter. And three, you know by now, I love being in conversation. That's why at each of my book stops, I will be in conversation with a favorite author, many of whom you have heard on this show, like Melissa Gould, author of Widowish, Steph Jagger, author of Everything Left to Remember, and so many more. I can't wait to meet you, hug you, answer your questions, and of course, take those selfies together. We can share them on Instagram at Lisa Kefauver MSW. Grief isn't on a schedule, and neither is my newsletter. That's why I call it the not-so-regular newsletter. Still, from time to time, I drop into your inbox with a new essay, a writing prompt or practice for you, news about my book and book tour, and sometimes behind-the-scenes scoops about this podcast. I would love to show up for you, too. It's easy. Just sign up for my free newsletter after the show by visiting lisakeefauver.com/newsletter. But, you know, that's interesting that you said that because I want to talk a little bit about what you understood when your mom just hopped on a plane to India and said, I'll be back whenever I'll be back kind of thing. I want to talk about that. But since you mentioned one of the themes that you talked about for your own survival, again, not being able to sort of be a kid, now you're making your dad coffee and making sure he's ready to go and checking on your sister and you're being an adult. But you said at one point, I wonder if I can read a little passage.
Sure.
Because you were talking about this weird thing that's like, because your mom does come back for a while and then goes again. But even though you were so close to your dad in a way, and you were really the parent, I mean, you know, you were a partner or an adult, you couldn't quite recognize or see how you belonged to him. There was a point in your life you talked about sort of not seeing how you belonged to him. You said, this is a passage, y'all, from When She Comes Back, Ronnie. It's a beautiful memoir. You said, my mother gave birth to me. I understood how I was a part of her, and people had said I looked like her, but this man could be any man. I didn't truly sense what we shared. How could I be certain I was connected to him? Because we were acting like it? Having been separated from him for nearly a year gave me some objective distance. In that moment, sitting on his bed, I partially floated above myself to look down on the scene, and I felt how he was a stranger to me. How did I really know he was my father? How do you know you belong to someone? People make a bargain to take care of one another, but they can just as easily decide not to do so anymore. What if he'd said no, he wouldn't take us that summer? What if he'd decided he didn't want a relationship with us?
You know, I haven't read that part in so long. In all the readings I did and the guesting on podcasts, I never picked that, nor did anyone else. And I'm like, I'm hearing it like you are for the first time.
Whew. I just wanted to name that I see you and I see young Ronit in this. And I think probably a lot of our listeners, again, though they didn't have a mom, you know, a dad who left and then sort of had to be coerced into keeping you because their mom went to India to be a part of a cult, even though that's not what they were calling it at the time. I think for many of us, we have that point, if we've lived in that kind of disorganized childhood, which I think, by the way, so many Gen Xers in general did. I think that was a generational thing, of that feeling of that in that search of belonging, in part because other losses that we experience, the death loss of somebody in a more, you know, what we think of as a more traditional loss, can then kick up all of these old losses that we haven't really named as loss, because there are these where people abandon us even when they're still present.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. And yeah, we can do that in so many ways. And I do that really, I'm gratified to know, like when I think back on that piece of the book, I really did have that floaty feeling. You know, sometimes when you're writing, you maybe superimpose different memories or different elements of your story where they belong. But I'm really happy that I chose to put it right there, because it really did happen. It was one of those, you're getting older and you realize, wait a minute, you know, and you have to when you're a kid like that to survive as well. Again, saying the word survive, because you're trying to figure out what's the glue. What is going to keep me safe? And that's the way that people who grow up like this, a lot of people understand it, to, you have to have your tools and resources and your weapons ready to go. Yeah. And that's why the thing is, I'm so different now. I mean, I still have that New York edge, that savviness that can kick into high gear, that anxiety if I need it. But I've learned so much, and I don't know that I could have written the book the way I did. I'm sure I couldn't have had I not done a lot of work with my husband on our own relationship, because of course the toll of this kind of being left in abandonment is that
shows often, up in relationship. Oh,
yeah. You just think, oh, well, I said to my mom once, you'll appreciate this. Halfway through my marriage or 5 years into my marriage, I said, I just thought that me and my husband were going to be fine because we liked each other so much and we got along and knew each other better than you and dad. And I just thought it was going to be easy. And my mom, she just started laughing and she said, why would you think that? And I thought it was so funny because I just thought my dad and my mom were mismatched, you know, that's what had happened. But now all these years, I just celebrated my 20th anniversary with my husband. Like 2 days ago, as of this recording, and we can't believe how much we've learned and gone through. We've both had to learn a lot, and it's so easy to lose people, and you can't always control what happens. But I can't believe we made it this far, because I had my work cut out for me, and so did he. And I think part of the reason I was able to write the book the way I did is because I had a lot of work on vulnerability and understanding my own patterns. Yeah. And that has helped me be, I think, a better person, a better friend, a better podcast host, a better writer, et cetera, better teacher. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because when we're not in that sort of activated anxious state, we can be present, we can listen, we can hold space. But for all of us, when we are kicked into that sort of fight or flight or freeze or fawn state, we aren't actually able to be sort of present and engaged in relationships.
Not at all. I think I spent the first, it's not an exaggeration to say, I probably spent the first 20 years of my life at least, assuming that the person I talked to at any given time wanted a bolt and wasn't that interested in me. So I had to just either be completely engaging or talk really fast so that they wouldn't be bored and reject me first.
For sure. For sure. That's why I'm saying I resonated a lot. I have a lot of history of that and kind of walking in the world being dissociated. But I want you to, for those folks who haven't seen Wild Wild Country or don't know much about Bhagwan and about the cults and about what happened when your mom went away, as you learned years later, what was her experience? Was she in touch? Did you have a sense that she was ever coming back? Tell us about that first.
Yeah.
Because she left twice, once in India and then once to the settlement they created in Oregon. But
yeah,
she was in Israel. I mean, not Israel, in India.
Yeah.
What did you know then? And
so I knew she was gone for the summer. She had just dropped us off in New Jersey for the summer, and she was supposed to come back in September to grab us and take us back to Seattle. But
as she was gone, and we didn't really talk to her, maybe there was occasion for her to say in a letter, I'm going to call on this day. But there's a couple of times when she just doesn't call. And that's in the book as well, because I wanted her to come back. I mean, I'm living with my dad and his girlfriend and her two daughters who are teenagers. And it's a very small place. And the girls aren't happy to have us there, nor is the girlfriend. It was very easy to see that. Yeah. I mean, I picked that up. Talk about feeling like no one wants you around. I was like, I know these girls do not want me here.
My mom doesn't want to be here. The mother figure in my life doesn't want me to be here. The girls don't because they're teenagers. And
no, they're like, what? Yeah. This was our pretend dad. What are you doing here? You know? Yeah. And I think they liked my sister because she was super adorable. And it's not inaccurate to say, you know, I don't think we got along very well. I think I was a pain in the ass older kid who was like, what is going on? Yeah. And I'm not apologetic for the way I behaved. I mean, I was doing my best. So I think that, so my mom was supposed to come back, and then she just kept delaying it and saying she was going to be longer. So my dad had to hurry and register me for school because my sister was still young. And so I did second grade last minute. He had to register us with the school district. And then there's a scene which I keenly remember. He had to drop me off at school the first day of school in second grade, and I lost it.
Yeah.
I absolutely lost it, because my father, this is when it all, the rubber hit the road, I think, because I thought I'd been okay up until then, but the idea that my father was now dropping me off at a building with a whole bunch of strangers and telling me he would come back at the end of the day, I mean, forget it. I could not take care of myself. And that is in the book too. That was one of my earliest memories that helped me create the structure for the book. It was painful. It's even hard thinking about it now. And he was upset too. He had to stay strong. I mean, of course, he didn't cry, but in front of me, but it was awful. It was just awful. And so then my mom ended up not coming back until the summer. And she came back changed with a little.
So she was sort of luminescent. And
yeah, she was gorgeous. Big, glowing fluffy hair. And, you know, genie pants and all the colors of the sunset and jangly anklets and a mala with the picture of her guru at the end and a nose ring and gorgeous, but just changed. Not the mom I remembered. Yeah. The mom I'd been keeping in my head, because you have photos and memory, but you're young, 6 years old, seven.
Yeah.
So, that was, you know, and then we thought she was going to stay, but we didn't end up living with her right away. We just saw her on the weekends until she left again. So,
yeah.
And I should note, she came back because her mom had breast cancer and was not doing well. I don't know, had her mom not gotten ill, when she would have come back.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book. And that scene when he's dropping you at school, yet another one of the many times my heart broke over and over again for you, for little Ronit in the book. But you mentioned that she came back. And even that, as you sort of reflected on, I think later in the book, you know, she had, her mother was very abusive to her. And so the complexity of her coming back to, quote unquote, care for her mother in the end, it was sort of a double whammy. Like, would she have come back to see me if her mom wasn't sick? And here now she has to come back and care for somebody who treated her so badly. Yeah.
Yes. And I should mention, there is a sort of, you know, my mom's family settled in Brooklyn, Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. They had left Europe, that were Jews, like were Ashkenazi Jews. And they had left Europe before World War I. Like, they weren't there during the Holocaust. My dad's family lived in the Bronx, but the lineage is Odessa and Poland. And, you know, there's generational trauma, Jewish, there's epigenetics, you know, there's sort of like this, her mom was a really not a good mom, and how much of that is her environment and what she was raised with. So it's all this stuff, but there's a very specific brand of this kind of Jewish mom, because I've interviewed people for my own podcast who had moms like this that my mom had.
Yeah.
And, you know, it might be a specific thing to this kind of Jewish culture, or it might just be, you know, bad moms. I don't know.
Well, I do think there is, and I think this happens in other areas, but I mean, we've talked many times on the show. We've had Rachel Yehuda on the show, who's studied intergenerational trauma, is that happens among all, in all kind of communities, but certainly in the Jewish community. Well, what I wanted to say was, I think I appreciate that you're naming not just that your mom. And I wanted to read another passage, because there's a point later in the book. I'm kind of skipping around a little bit because I want to talk when she leaves again. But I think this is important, because so many of us, whether or not we're Jewish or not or whatever our family makeup, are coming to grips with the fact that we may have experienced trauma in our lifetime, and we may have experienced, you know, disorganized or insecure attachment from our parents, but we're starting to recognize that our parents are that way because they had parents who also had their own unresolved trauma. And we know now, not only does it pass down generationally because of the way we do and don't show up in parenting ways, in loving ways, but also it changes our actual genetic makeup. And then we have an increased propensity for things like anxiety, et cetera. So I do appreciate the way that you named that. You know, you said, again, you know, your mom came back, but you weren't living with her. She was a changed woman, but not so changed that she was all of a sudden a mothering person for you, but she was now having to subject herself to the care of her mother, who even I think in the end was still saying sort of crude and rude things to her. And that there was no, like, you know, I'm sorry.
There wasn't.
There's no, like, I'm sorry for all I did. And
no,
you know,
I don't think so. No,
but you know, I'm, this is just a piece of a bit. And I think this was later after your mom, after it came, your mom went to Oregon, which we're going to talk about again with the settlement that Bhagwan created in Oregon and the cult and everything that happened. But you talked about sort of coming to grips with understanding that you didn't need to understand why your mom would follow a man, a guru, around the world at the expense of you all, but you could understand the impulse because of everything that she went through. You said, it's hard to see how any rational adult would buy such a claim, but in some ways, it doesn't matter if I believe in what Bhagwan was selling or what he stood for. I can believe in people believing him. I can't fault someone for falling for a person or an idea that made them feel safe and loved. I understand safe. I understand the desire to belong. Don't we all want to know we are accepted and secure? If you feel untethered, it can be hard to make good choices. What my mother wanted from the ashram is what I wanted from her. I believed in her. She believed in Bhagwan. We both lost. Yeah. And that's core loss that you're experiencing and that so many of us have experienced was like that core loss of safety and belonging. And for you to have that perspective to sort of see your mom's actions, not that it was okay, by the way, feel like, you know, like it still wasn't okay, but you could see the common humanity in her.
Right. I mean, everyone's, I don't know, sometimes doesn't it feel like everyone's just a small child? We're just all searching for safety and belonging or love. I mean, I just think so many people, we just want to feel acceptance and that we're okay. I think that's at the root of so much of what we all do in our life all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, when I check Instagram, aren't I looking to make sure I'm okay and people love me?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm good friends with them. And he was on the podcast a few years ago, John Powell, who's the head of the Othering and Belonging Institute there in Berkeley. And, you know, he and I have talked over the years. And I think we all know this is that, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of need with food, water, shelter. Yeah. But at its core is that sense of belonging and safety, that there's a we, that there was the most expansive us that we can possibly imagine. But for so many of us at the cultural level, for sure, when we think about racism and anti-Semitism and all the ways in which we other people, but even in our family systems, like how much do we need and deserve belonging and how often do we not feel that?
So it goes wrong so much of the time.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how, like, you know, millennia ago, when people were just beginning to be communal like that and be mammally, like human, like how often it went wrong back then, because it certainly goes wrong now.
Yeah. I mean, modernity for sure has a lot of benefits and we live longer and there's lots of things. And as I talk often about the show, I think there's a lot about our culture and the ways in which we live separated from one another that actually pushes that sort of core wound, to its side. So kind of taking us back, so your mother comes back, she's sort of this changed, luminous woman, but she's still not taking you in, you and your sister in full time. They're still kind of seeing weekends and kind of going back and forth. She's now befriends a woman named, self-named Karma,
Yeah. And actually, that I have to say that was her real name, because I changed all the names, was just as bad. I'll say it now because I'm not worried. Her name that she gave to herself or someone gave to her was Nirvana.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And so I was like, what's comparable to that for this book? I said, karma. Same thing. So, so she, you know, this is the thing. I don't know if my mom just looked like a mark. She's in the city. She's living in Manhattan. We see her on the weekends or every other weekend. Things seem fairly stable. But what's funny is my mom has a studio apartment that's really small. It's not like she was waiting.
She was not creating a space for you and your sister to come live. Yeah.
Though we did love being there. And I will say that toward the time right before my mom leaves to Oregon, she and my sister are looking at apartments for my mom to take us. Mm-hmm. And this was another opportunity for my mom to, we were like, oh, we're going to live with my mom. You know, I'm
finally, she's choosing us and we're going to repair. And
yes, exactly. So, then, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. She meets this woman at one of these self-growth est type of things. Are you familiar with est?
I only through your book, but one of those things in that era of like.
That's a Earhart training seminars.
Yeah.
No, seminar training. Yeah.
Yeah.
Est. Anyway, so, he was a precursor. He created like the forum later and stuff, but he had these things where you're supposed to go to these conferences and transform. And it was a very big deal in the 80s. But she goes to one of these things and meets this woman who must have just seen my mom and known right away, aha. And she says, oh, well, there's a ranch in Oregon. You know, I've just come back, or it's supposed to be great. So before you know it, my mom has decided she's going to go back to Bhagwan in Oregon for the summer, because he's got this place in Antelope that he's created. It's called Rajneeshpuram. And we didn't know. We're just like, wait, what? Like, you know, now in hindsight, you see footage of it on Wild Wild Country and stuff, and you get all this documentation about what was going on. But for us, it just felt like, wait, Bhagwan again? You're going back out? You're going to fall? He's here? You can imagine. It's like having a rug pulled out from under you. India is one thing.
Right.
But if he's on, you know, on the continent, like that's like really scary.
Yeah.
And so then while she went to Oregon, this woman ended up, you know, liquidating a lot of her stuff and running up her credit cards and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And my mom left again, and she was supposed to come back after 2 weeks, you know, but then while we were at summer camp, me and my sister sleep away, we got letters saying she was going to stay. And it was just like, again, you know.
And this, and now you're 13, 14 or something?
I'm like 12 or so, 12, 13, because my bat mitzvah was that fall. And
which
she did
didn't
come back
come
for.
I know, I read that too. And even I could hear the self-protective version of you at that age saying, it's fine that she didn't come because I didn't really care about my bat mitzvah, which maybe is true on some level, but also I could see the armor, right, that you had to build, because how can you keep putting your hope out there?
Right. But then you'll notice, and I think I want to mention that then after that happens, I get to tell everyone, oh, my mom didn't come for my bat mitzvah. And I get to say it in like this, like very offhanded, I'm so brittle. And can you imagine her not coming? It was like my one-liner. I write in the book, I think, my abandoned by my mother one-liner, you know, cause it's, but then later on, I got to look back at it, especially when my daughter got bat mitzvahed, you know, just like, whoa, this was really big.
Right.
You know,
but, and again, you have to like, again, there, I think there's that self-protective mechanism. It's like, you have to make it this one-liner, because if you really lean into the deep hurt, like how could you hold that? Nobody had shown you how to hold that pain. So she's out there saying, again, I have to follow my spiritual path. This is my thing. That's the time you were at summer camp and learned that Bhagwan was just not this spiritual leader that she's following.
Exactly right.
Tell us a little of the story how you learned about
that.
This
we're sitting at camp. You know, it's like we're sitting at the sleepaway camp.
As we begin to wind down today's conversation, Ronit reveals how and when she learned that Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, the spiritual leader her mom followed to India and again to Oregon, was not some innocent, enlightened being, but instead the head of a serious, harmful, and dangerous cult, the one you may have seen in the Netflix documentary Wild, Wild Country. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver, and you're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. Friends, I got the sweetest note the other day from a listener. Oh, my heart. Patricia emailed me at info@lisakefauver.com to say this. I wanted to let you know that I pre-ordered your book and I'm excited for it to be published. You don't know this, but you and I walk together most every day through the joy of your podcasts. And I finally figured out how to leave a 5-star review, though you are deserving of far more than just 5 stars. Thank you for being a healing presence in the grief world. I cannot tell you how much her note meant to me, how much it means to me every time I see a new 5-star rating, read a kind review, and get notes like these in my inbox. Hosting this show is absolutely 100% a highlight of my life. And yet, since I don't do them live yet, I don't always hear how it impacts the audience. So please take a few minutes after the show today, head to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, follow the show, then click all 5 stars to leave a rating, and click that pen button to write a review about what the show has meant to you. Also, I'm thinking about getting a voicemail set up so you can leave me questions to answer on the show from time to time. Would you like that? You may have heard that I took a break from taking on new individual clients in 2023. As I navigated breast cancer treatment, I did, however, continue to see former clients on a drop-in basis. As I move into the final phase of my treatment and am feeling stronger, I'm happy to say, I'm opening just a few spots for new clients soon. I'm offering a 6-session package that is ideal for newly grieving individuals facing all kinds of loss, death, illness, divorce, or relationship ending, major life transitions, and more, or individuals further down the road who are looking for specialized grief care as a supplement to other therapeutic supports. Over our time together, you will feel held and cared for, have a chance to tap inward to discover your existing skills and resources, discover some of the barriers or shoulds getting in your way, cultivate a mindfulness practice essential for easing suffering, identify your emerging needs as a griever, and begin to build the community of support you will need as you continue on your journey. After you complete your 6-session package, you will be considered an existing client and qualified to sign up for check-in and tune-up sessions as available. Open enrollment periods happen only a few times per year. To learn more and reserve your spot today, after the show, visit lisakefauver.com/support.
And they gather us for sort of a group, a camp-wide conversation. And this man is talking to us. Now, you know, because Jews are such a minority, we're 0.2% of the entire world population. I think there's some help for Jewish, you know, growth and Jewish religion and culture. People want to foster that. And so they brought this guy who starts talking to us about cults and places that are not so good that might, you know, steer you away from your Jewish roots or might try to compromise you. So you should be aware of them. And we're just like, you know, as early teenagers, 12, what the like, heck whatever. Is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they even had the little ones there too, because my sister was about 9 and her group was there too. So we're just blah, blah, blah. I mean, we're interested because it's something different for the day. But then he starts to talk about the signs of a cult. And so I start to realize, wait a minute. Like, you know, like, and I
separate describe, you from your family.
And, yeah, yeah. Wear the same kinds of clothes. You know, all have certain lingo and ways to talk, all these things that, yeah. you know, are happening. And I realize, oh my gosh. And so my friends kind of know my story and they push me to talk to him afterward. And this is not about me, you know?
Yeah.
And my sister and I, you know, we just are like sobbing by the end of it because we realize, okay, so mom is not coming back in 2 weeks. And she turns out she's at a cult. So this is great.
Yeah, this is great news. This is great news. And yeah. you learned first when you were like observing her with her friend Karma/Nirvana
yeah.
and other places. For those who haven't seen Wild Wild Country, what do we know now? I want to talk about how the whole Oregon
yeah,
debacle ended and she came back into your life again. But what do we, I mean, you maybe didn't know it then at 12 or 13, but what do we know about that particular cult?
You know, what happened was they bought this giant, what was the Big Muddy Ranch, this lots of property in Oregon at Antelope, and they kind of irrigated it and created structures as many acres. I forgot how many. It's in the book, I think.
Yeah.
And they cultivated the land and they got some of their best members, followers, to create these gorgeous, gorgeous buildings and gorgeous landscape and make everything like give up beautiful like fields and lovely, lovely crops. And they created an airstrip for an airport. They had their own little post office. It was like a town, Rajneeshpuram, Rancho Rajneesh.
Yeah.
People had to wear colors of the sunset. They had to wear their malas. They would have this world, I don't even know what it was, World Religion Day or something. And everyone would fly in from all the different followers in Australia and Europe, everywhere. And they would come and they would do this trans dynamic meditation and they would chant and they would, the whole idea was to take you out of your body. And the other thing is that it was supposed to be that you gave your body freely. You could have sex with whomever you wanted and you didn't care about the children. And something that happened was kids were housed separately and they were sort of forgotten. So people were encouraged not to worry about their children, that they needed to follow their bliss. And of course, I'm just kind of condensing all this.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people who were there would say, well, you're kind of oversimplifying it. But the kids were not looked after. Kids were not seen as a resource. Kids were not seen as something to be cherished. Kids were expendable. And I will say that there were a lot of reports of people who were on the ranch. There was sexual abuse and assault. Now, I'm not saying that it was like an organized abuse of children.
Yeah.
But kids were groomed because sex was considered a natural part of human growth. You would see grown men basically grooming 12-year-old, 11-year-old girls. You would see them holding hands. Yeah. There would be like a race to deflower the girls. Women and men would be just having sex all the time. And so kids went by the wayside, basically.
Yeah.
So I asked my mom, you know, I said, when you saw children on the ranch or even in India, did you think about us, right? Because it's one thing to go for yourself and to follow your own energy and what you're searching for. But if you saw children, wouldn't you even think about your
kids?
What
if this was my,
like, where did that go? And she really didn't. I did not ever get a concrete or satisfying answer to that. But I just, you know, I know that I'm lucky that I didn't go to the ashram. I didn't go to India because she did want to bring us to India, actually. But her friend said, don't do that. It's too dangerous. Thank God that I didn't live on the ashram in India.
Yeah.
And I didn't live on the ashram in Oregon. And I didn't want to go to the one in Oregon. I was old enough to know by then. No way.
Yeah.
But.
And so how long was she there until the whole, because it got basically raided shut down.
Yeah. She was there for the tail end of it, actually.
Like,
talk about timing. I mean, she didn't get out there until 6 months before the whole thing, you know, closed down because the FBI got involved. Because there was wiretapping, there was poisoning of elected officials, there was intimidation of townspeople, a whole bunch of stuff. There was, they poisoned salad bars with salmonella trying to sway an election. I mean, there was all this stuff going on. And they became, this is the thing about, I've had conversations like this with other people who know about the ashram. When you have a narcissistic organization, when you have a leader who's so narcissistic and so bloated with their own power, often they make a trail because they video everything. Yeah. They record everything. They keep documents. They also got into trouble for like human trafficking or immigration problems. So this stuff brought them down and gave the FBI a way to sort of shut it down. And then he tried to escape and he fled. And then they caught him while he was in transit and his, you know, anyhow. So my mom was there as it started to get shut down. And I write that in the book because I can imagine you're there. These people are there and the buses start hauling everyone out. You have to leave because it's shutting down. And so they lost their home as well. So here we go again. All these people who thought they'd found their nirvana, the solution to everything in their lives was being shut down and they had to leave as well. So my mom fled to Seattle. She came back to New York shortly, and then there was a big fight between her and my father, and then she fled again, and she went to, you know, Seattle. So, and ironically, I live in Seattle now.
I know. She had said, a friend had said to you, like, are you trying to self-punish or, you know, what you're trying to do?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, what? Because I grew up in New York for the most part. Yeah.
Yeah. You did grow up and you talked about some hard things. Not only were you sort of having to parent your dad, but then had that sort of adolescent thing, especially as a girl with a dad, of like needing to have some separation. You were vulnerable. You talked about being sort of, you know, harassed and assaulted on the street. Like you had a kind of self-sufficient, tough upbringing. You were kind of negotiating with his girlfriends who would come and go, who were who would kind of mom, but not really be kind of a mother figure for you. But again, so there your mom experienced her own loss. She thought she had found belonging. She lost everything, but still didn't come take you all back with her. And so I wonder if you, what, how did you make meaning of that at that time? Because you were, you know, a
super depressed. I mean, I think that by the time I was in middle school, because we called it, junior high school over there. That was for seventh, eighth, and ninth graders. And so I was at this school for seventh and eighth grade and then got into a music program for ninth grade at a high school. But I was just, I think the bottom just fell out. I was just, you know, I was not happy. I was really dim. My light was dim. I think that was just, that was like the final straw, you know, the stuck in adolescence, stuck in this apartment with my father and sister, no hope that my mom was going to come back. Just, you know, all those years you can live, I think you can live in hardship knowing things might change, but when hope goes away, I think you just hit the ground. There's just nowhere to go. And I think I'd always sort of thought, well, you know, this is just temporary or something else will happen. Or I don't know. I just hadn't thought that this was it. And so by seventh and eighth grade, I was just, I think I was really sad and kind of tired, you know, really tired of, you know, holding up that candle. But then, you know, life happens. My dad met a woman, they started dating, and then I went to high school and I had some fun and realized, okay, there's other stuff I can do. And you move on. You just, you kind of pick yourself up. But I definitely started thinking about taking my own life. I definitely was taking diet pills. I didn't feel pretty or good. I felt like not enough. I felt too much. All the things, you know, they all kind of just started to swirl around. It was a very hard time, hard time.
Yeah. Again, one of the many ways in which you share so beautifully and vulnerably. And I think so many people will feel seen as they read it. Again, not because they went through your specific story, but, you know, the being too much and being not enough, and especially for women in this culture and of the size and your voice. You know, something you said there is like, we need hope in these ways. And part of what was happening is you were in the cycle of hoping your mom would come back and choose you. And then you sort of, she'd show up and then she would disappear again. And that hope and the destitution that you felt, that so many of us felt when we're not chosen. And I don't want to oversimplify this, but something that you just said reminded me when I was reading the book, it was not that you resolved and were okay with your mom not choosing you, not having you come back. But when you found something that lit you up, which for you was sort of singing and theater and performance, I wonder if you would describe that as like, that was a locus of where hope could go, like that there was possibility of joy or something in life of that community.
I think that for me, you know, it's funny when you think about what's your natural inclination, what's your natural set point? Are you an optimistic person? Are you a pessimistic person? Yeah. Are you naturally happy? You know, what would be my natural set point had all this not happened? I don't know. But I do know that I loved expressing myself. I loved singing. I needed to be the center of attention. Of course, maybe some of that had to do with being relevant and not left, of course.
Yeah.
But I loved being chosen. I loved auditioning for something and getting it. I loved sending out writing and getting it accepted. I loved getting picked. Like I really do. It fulfilled, or still does, a sense inside of me that I'm okay. So some of that will never go away. I mean, I still get a rush when I get something accepted for publication, or when someone asks me to do something, or I get something. Like it still feeds that sort of, okay, I'm all right, or I did it, you know? So there's something about music that is music and doing shows and performing is so joyful and collaborative and close and so concentrated that I think that when you're performing and you're rehearsing, there's not a lot of room for other stuff. It's transporting. Yeah. So I think that's how I found it. But I think my sister's also a performer and a writer. And we both had that urge. We come from very hammy people. we're very performative, you know, and so it's always been in us. And story has also been in it. My sister is a screenwriter and a TV writer and also a voiceover artist. And my dad is a writer. We just need to tell stories, connect with people, teach people, relate, and like try to understand. I think the biggest driving force within me has always been to analyze, to understand, and to make sense of stuff, which now I realize makes perfect sense that I became a writer, because my whole life I was trying to understand and draw conclusions and find meaning.
Yeah.
And now that's where I put my energy as a writer and a podcaster.
Yeah, I love that so much. And you do it so beautifully. And I think, you know, we talk often on this show, and I talk often from my work, even from my training as a narrative therapist, was we are storytelling creatures. That's kind of in our DNA as humans. It's how we make meaning. It's how we evolve. It's how we feel safe, connected, thrive. And I think for those of us who had disorganization or chaos or trauma in our life, story feels even more urgent because we're trying to, you know, comprehend the incomprehensible, or we're trying to sort of make meaning out of something. And the way that you have gone on to do that, I think, is such a beautiful testament to that impulse, you know, that we all have, but that you sort of use.
Yes. And I love how you talk about the organizational, like, did you call it disorganized childhood?
Yeah.
I've never heard that either. So I love talking to you. That's exactly right. So to try to find order somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. So many of us can say like, oh, I didn't have, you know, my parents were nice or whatever, but sometimes it's the inconsistency or the, you know, the disorganization that can lead us there. You know, I can't, of course, an hour has already gone by. So we're going to wrap up for this conversation. I'm sure we'll have more, but I wanted to have you share with us. Readers might be surprised to know that you are still in relationship with both of your parents who live in the area now, who you have over for Shabbat dinners and have conversations, but you know, you're still in conversation and maybe would use the word close with your mom. And I know you even kind of got up the courage, you shared towards the end of the book. I don't know if I marked it that exactly page, but to sort of have a conversation to sort of push your mom about like, how could you do that? And did you know that you were missing out? And, you know,
yeah, in the epilogue,
in your epilogue, you share that, you know, she even mentions that she has a lot of grief, you know, over her choices. What allowed you to be still in relationship? What has been a gift?
I think about that a lot because I know it comes up as a question. I think, well, really at its core, I mean, I would never be secure enough with myself or, I mean, I always wanted to be picked. Yeah. I'm always available.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just say that for a long time, I made poor choices in romance too, as you can imagine. But I think that for my mom, I would never be someone who would shut the door. I don't think it would take a lot for me to shut the door on someone.
Yeah.
And my mom, there's always where there's life, there's hope. Right. And so maybe that was working for me. And, you know, we just have a strong sense of family. And also I would see my mom in the summers with my sister. We'd come out to Seattle and see her. And those were beautiful times away from Queens where I was living, beautiful times with gorgeous, you know, blue skies and no pollution and no cockroaches and delicious food that my mom made for us and an adventure and a break from our New York life. So I would take it and I liked it. And so we stayed in touch all those years and I would still call my mom and, you know, we were working it out. I stayed put, maybe knowing, maybe not knowing that one day it would be better or just being willing to accept it. But then over the years, we've just gotten closer and closer. She helped me when my kids were born. We still see each other. We laugh so hard. And in fact, I would say we're closer now even than what I wrote in the book. Like it just got better. And I would say also, this is miraculous. Look, when I was writing the memoir, it caused a lot of like feelings for me. I'd had to distance myself emotionally a little bit from my parents. They could feel it when the book came ready to get published. I share the manuscript with them and my sister. I talk a lot about that when I teach memoir about sharing manuscripts. I'm happy to expound on that.
Yeah.
But I was worried about their reaction and it caused some tension. And my mom was actually relieved. She said, it's a lot better than I thought it would be the way you depict me. Thank you.
Well, because you give her three-dimensionality as we talked about earlier.
My father and I had some friction. He was not happy with the way he was depicted, but we had some problems in the last couple of years. We always bump up against each other, probably because we know each other so well, but we just had lunch last week and we decided to have lunch. We do this sometimes. And I let down my guard. I was more open and more accepting of my father and less harsh on him than I've ever been. And I'll tell you, I feel closer to my father now than I have ever, like since I was a kid, because I think we needed to heal that because yeah. I lost a part of my father early on because of what happened. Yeah. And he was like my hero for so long. And I've just been so hard on him for so many years. And I finally feel like I can rest, you know, like we're back where we belong in a way.
Yeah.
So memoir can do that, you know?
Yeah. It's so powerful. It's so powerful. And in addition, everyone, for you to go out, excuse me, and get your copy of When She Comes Back, I encourage you to listen to, Let's Talk Memoir, one of your two podcasts in addition to, and then Everything Changed.
Yes. And also if you're more of an audiobook person, I did record When She Comes Back audio. It's about 6 hours of listening and you can do that too.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I just recorded my
I know. I wanted too. To ask you how it went.
Oh my God. I loved it. I would like to do it for other people.
You have a beautiful voice. I would totally listen to your book.
I was totally, I was like, ooh, I want to record other people's books. But anyways, but either way, whether you read it or listen to it, and I can imagine it being such a powerful listen, I really encourage you to do that and to learn from Roni, including like your workshops and the work that you do around memoir, because whether or not, it's interesting to me, I haven't written a memoir yet. I'm sure it's in me. But one of the things that I appreciated as I read your book and sort of sat with it, and even now having had this conversation, is whether you decide you're going to write a memoir for the world, you know, that you're going to publish and it's going to be out in the world, I see so much and hear today so much in that the process of doing it is its own reward.
I think so. It's hard work, but it really... I don't know, when you're working well and you're really interrogating your behavior and hoping to learn things and being curious, it's a great service to you and to your relationships.
Yeah. Curiosity is always a gift. I mean, I think that's 100% how I try. I don't always succeed.
We're human.
But how I try to live my days, Rainier says, live into the questions, right? Mm. And maybe someday along some distant future, you know, the answers will come. Paraphrasing there, but anyway. thank you so much for joining me on Grief as a Sneaky Bitch today. This has been amazing. And I know it's not the last of our conversations, but it's been such an honor to be with you and to be with your story.
I love talking with you. I'm so happy we know each other and that we've been able to stay in touch and that you invited me on. I love talking this way. And I want to tell you, Lisa, of course, you brought out stuff, you know, elements of my story and facets of my history that I hadn't thought about in a long time or in quite this way. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Oh, my friends, this conversation still lingers in my mind and weighs on my heart days after we had it. The same is true about both the stories from and the insights I gleaned from her extraordinary and, as I've called it before, brutiful, as in brutal and beautiful, memoir, When She Comes Back. If you've ever experienced grief and loss because of abandonment or attachment in your own life, I hope you feel seen and held by our conversation today. I encourage you to pick up a copy of her book, When She Comes Back, as well as listen to her podcasts, And Then Everything Changed, and Let's Talk Memoir. You can learn more in the show notes for today's episode. Thank you again for listening. And remember, if you found it helpful, don't forget to share this episode with others who might need it too. If you do it on socials, don't forget to tag me at Lisa Kiefhoffer MSW. And of course, if you loved the show, it would mean the world to me if you left a 5-star rating and wrote a review. Oh, and this season, I've committed to releasing the unedited video version of these episodes on my new YouTube channel at Lisa Kiefhoffer MSW. Thanks to Mike Moody at Record ATX for the audio engineering support, and Giles Smith of Alafia Sounds for providing the music. Until next time, I see you, I hear you, and I'm holding you in my heart.